Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Orley, and I'm joined by my co-host, Tom Coffeen. And today, we're going to talk about IPv6 and DNS, the two critical things that help the internet actually be the internet. And we're joined by Cricket Liu with Infoblox to talk about his work around DNS. So Cricket, welcome to the IPv6 Buzz. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and maybe why IPv6 is of interest of you, and obviously you clearly are interested in DNS, so you can tell us a little bit about that too.
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks for having me on, Ed. I've been doing DNS now for, goodness, 30 years, I think.
You admit that in public?
Yep. Yeah, it's hard to believe. I have a couple of friends who every time we get together, which is not particularly frequently, they say, "Are you still doing that DNS thing?"
Is that still a thing on the internet?
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, it is.
Can you recall the first time you stumbled across IPv6 and sort of what your initial reflections on that were?
Well, I remember I was going to IETF meetings more frequently back in the 90s. And that was sort of when the IPv6 community within the IETF had its heads down, its collective heads down, and was really working on the development of IPv6. And of course, there were sort of corresponding efforts within the DNS working groups at IETF to come up with some sort of a scheme for mapping domain names to IPv6 addresses and reverse mapping IPv6 addresses back to domain names. The first of those efforts was what they call the A6 record. I don't know if you guys remember the A6 record at all?
I do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a vestige that we have to talk about occasionally here and there.
Yeah. So I think that was probably the first I actually started working with IPv6 was back in the DNS EXT, the DNS extensions working group in the IETF back in the 90s.
I remember seeing a headline about that a little while back, that there were still A6 requests floating around out there even after years of it being deprecated.
Oh, I'm sure that's the case. I mean, there's almost nothing that ever goes away in DNS. It just sort of agglomerates.
That's right.
Yeah. So after our brief, misguided foray into A6, the DNS community kind of got their bearings, and we went forward with the Quad A record and IP6.int, which was later IP6.ARPA, and we've been pretty much ready, I would say, for IPv6 since then. Mm-hmm. Sort of drumming our fingers and waiting for adoption of IPv6 to actually catch up.
Cool. Well, I mean, in terms of the DNS side, I mean, I know early on there was some sort of debate back and forth about structurally was not necessarily debate, but some comments about how much of a change would we actually have to do to DNS to support V6? And you talked a little bit about that. Maybe you can break down just the addition of the Quad A record type and sort of like, hey, that's, where did that actually relate in? And I'm assuming it was a pretty quick code change to be able to support those additional record types. Was there anything else that was really outside of the inverse portion? Was there anything else consideration wise that had to be thought about? I think it was pretty straightforward, right?
It really was. I mean, A6 was crazy. I mean, it was really complicated. The A6 record, basically, you guys would probably remember that the magic of the A6 record was that you'd map a domain name to like some textual labels followed by some, but not all, of the bits of the IPv6 address. And then you would do consecutive lookups to map those textual labels to other portions of the IPv6 address. So mapping a name to a complete 128-bit IPv6 address could take quite a bit of doing, right? Quite a bit of name resolution.
Right.
And once they jettisoned that idea, they went with the Quad A record. The Quad A record is very simple. It just maps a domain name directly to all 128 bits of an IP address. That's it.
Right. But what was the reason that they were trying to break this down? I mean, early on, I mean, maybe for the listeners, they may not have a clue about how constrained we were within both bandwidth and sort of the size constraints that we wanted to do on packets and how much traffic went back and forth. I mean, in the dial-up days, you really were concerned about, the size and the payload and things like that. We were trying to optimize around very different things. in these early stages about how big your route tables were, about how much, you know, for DNS lookups, how much data and as was it as compact as possible. I think those are some of the rationales that they were working their way through versus just saying we're going to take 128 bits every single time.
Yeah, actually, the reason that they were doing it the way they were with those ASIC records was for flexibility. They wanted to be able to specify that, for example, this host would map to maybe a number of different prefixes, a number of different IPv6 prefixes, colon, and then the rest of the IPv6 address. So, for example, if you got an IPv6 prefix that was specific to the provider assigning it, maybe you got two different prefixes. Well, then you'd have to advertise two different IPv6 addresses, but they might be the same except for those prefixes. So the idea behind that ASIC record was, hey, I can say host.domain ASIC provider one prefix dot whatever or colon whatever and provider two prefix colon whatever.
Right? Oh, cool.
Yeah, okay.
So that's really, it's that kind of flexibility that they were trying to provide. But the cost on the infrastructure side of doing that resolution was very high, and also the administrative complexity of trying to explain to people, oh yeah, so here's what you got to do in order to map that prefix. And there were no actual limits that I can recall to the number of prefixes, right? So you could have one textual label that might correspond to the first 8 bits, and then another one that's the next 16 bits, and so on. So it could be multiple labels, and it just became very, very complex and very, very difficult for people to administer.
Yeah, well, and so maybe the fact that we ended up with the Quad A and IP6.ARPA, and that, you know, when we go to explain sort of what steps folks have to take to adopt IPv6, and we get to the DNS piece, there's almost always a sigh of relief, both in you know, the person that's sort of relating what the next steps are and the person that actually has to do it. And so we ended up with something, I think, that's infinitely simpler and sort of less prohibitive from an administrative standpoint and, you know, on the infrastructure, as it were. And so, you know, I guess that's a sort of a small blessing. It had ASIC seems like it would have been maybe eventually more of an impediment to IPv6 adoption, and the DNS that we have now with IPv6. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it just seems like it's one of the simpler aspects to the overall picture of how to adopt IPv6.
Yeah, I think it is. Also, if you think about it, Tom, I think that whole notion of having this shared prefix, I mean, that doesn't even really hold up, right? I mean, in most cases, I think if you're an organization and you've got multiple upstream providers, you have provider independent IPv6 space anyway, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting that to Tom's point in regards to the sort of simplification side, it also solved a big structural issue that V4 had in terms of reverse DNS, you know, sort of namespace delegation, because the way that they chose to build things out, and we learned our lesson, right? RC 2317, which is, for those that haven't had to implement that before, is just horrendously complex and has all sorts of different, you know, ways to get done amongst DNS providers for basically allocating something that's smaller than a slash 24 in IPv4 space, right?
Right, right.
And it's just not a lot of fun for someone who had to do a lot of that with a lot of folks. It's very easy to mess up. It's very hard to keep track of in a monitor, and it doesn't always work the way that you think.
Right.
So right. I think we got
some
we
upstream. Got some parents don't even, they won't even support it. You know, you can go to some service providers and say, hey, you know, I have a slash 27 from you guys. Will you delegate the RFC 2317 space? And they'll be like, no, sorry.
Yeah, give us the records you want in there, and we'll be happy to publish them for you. Yeah. Right. Yeah, which isn't super effective for those that are trying to be a little bit more dynamic on the web in terms of, like, you know, failover and high availability for mail services and stuff like that.
Right.
Problematic.
Well, and so that, and then of course that brings up the issue with IPv6, where we have these inordinately large subnet spaces that we're dealing with, and to reverse map those, obviously it becomes impossible. Like, not just unwieldy, but just literally impossible to you know. So what are some of the steps that we've sort of taken to work around that?
Well, I mean, there certainly are still some people who populate IP6.ARPA subdomains. Obviously, they're fairly thinly populated.
That's right.
You put pointer records so that you can reverse map important servers, servers that actually require reverse mapping for some reason. It might be a mail server, for example. That tends to be fairly common. You know, it might be some other application server that has to talk to another application server. But typically for clients, I think people don't bother anymore.
Mm-hmm. But that's more, that's true in the V4 space as well. And, you know, it's,
Yes. And there
was like this notion that we'd have a sort of crude authentication by having that, that reverse record there. And that's sort of fallen by the wayside over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. I think most people realize that that doesn't really provide you much of anything.
But it did change. It did change how we thought about DNS and some of the automated behaviors within Bind, for instance, right? About using the origin, you know, right? And saying like, hey, we'll go ahead and pre-populate everything from a reverse record basis into a file. It's not even feasible to do in V6 versus V4. V4, that's actually a doable thing. You can actually build a database for most reasonable size network configurations and still be able to get everything in there. In V6, it's not structurally possible to build that. So we switch from something that we could use maybe a static file to be able to define to something where we have to dynamically build information and provide it back. There's a little bit of difference in terms of maybe how DNS handles that part of it.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is actually the dollar generate.
Yeah.
So you're right, Ed. I mean, certainly there were folks who would populate an entire, say, /24 size reverse mapping zone in IPv4, and they just put, you know, add 254 pointer records or whatever to some sort of template domain names. Like, you know, sometimes it was just the IP address dot the domain. You know, like 10.0.0.1.foo.example or something like that.
Right.
And you could also do that with dollar generate, which is a bind specific control statement. And dollar generate is just a shorthand for creating those pointer records en masse. That's it. But yeah, you really can't do that with in IPv6, or you're going to generate so damn many pointer records that you're going to run out of memory.
That's right. Well, and we can be explicit on this point, and we should be, because it's fun. So if this the minimum routable prefix in V4, which is /24, and then you think, okay, well, let's do that in V6. It's a /48, and so it's 1.2 times 10 to the 24th total entries that you'd have in, in your reverse mapped file. Not going to happen.
Yeah, it's a big difference. At Infoblox, we actually have a database abstraction that will automatically generate things like pointer records in response to a query, so that these are not pointer records that actually live in a zone data file anywhere. They're automatically synthesized by the name server. So you can still do that with IPv6 reverse mapping zones. But, you know, as we've said, it becomes less and less imperative to do it because there's not that much that's actually looking at those reverse mapping entries.
So besides the original just quad A record type, there was some additional work that happened within the standards bodies to sort of help move V6 along from an adoption standpoint, because everyone really realized very quickly that it wasn't going to turn. We weren't going to have a flag day, number one, and then number two, that we needed some sort of transition mechanisms to sort of help move from where we're at, which was IPv4, and still probably you can argue pretty well today we're still on IPv4, and moving over to V6. And there were going to be cases where we might have some V6-only networks, there's some V4-only networks, and, you know, we needed ways to be able to obviously translate the protocols, but then at the same time, we needed some way to be able to point namespaces back and forth amongst each other. And so right. We came up with this crazy DNS64, NAT64 configuration to sort of help V6 clients be able to sort of discover and talk to V4 resources that were V4 only resources. So this is V6 only talking to V4 only. And most DNS appliances, I believe, support, you know, DNS64. What was that something that, obviously there's some conflicts out there for DNS64 with some security protocols and some other things there, but has it been something that a lot of folks have sort of widely adopted for sort of the public internet to solve that particular problem? I know, for instance, T-Mobile utilizes DNS64 and NAT64 to be able to solve some issues for their IPv6 only network that they run for their mobile provider.
Yeah, I think that most of the DNS64 and NAT64 adoption that I've seen is mainly in the carrier space, in mobile carrier space in particular. I don't I don't know of any enterprises that use it, for example. Of course, yeah. As you guys know, most enterprises have a lot of V4 internally anyway. I think there are not a lot of enterprises that are like, we're going to go IPv6 only. Maybe, you know, Facebook has said that they were going to do that, and maybe some other kind of forward-leaning enterprises. But yeah, most of it, I think, today is in mobile networks.
Well, it's a bit of a footnote, but it's probably, we might be neglectful if we don't mention that, you know, DNSSEC is something that DNS 6.4 breaks, right? Because you don't have the validation based on the fact that you're synthesizing a record that you can't really validate at the level that DNSSEC requires.
Yeah, that's right. Because it's usually a recursive DNS server that's performing DNS 6.4, you know, doing a lookup of, for example, a quad A record for some destination, finding out that there isn't one, and then looking up an A record, and then basically magically transmogrifying that A record into a quad A record. that quad A record does not really exist on the authoritative name server, and because it doesn't, if the zone that would have contained that synthesized quad A record is signed, well, the recursive doesn't have any way of also synthesizing the appropriate signature to cover that record.
That's right. So we're saved from that horrible fate by the fact that neither DNS 6.4 nor DNSSEC are widely deployed yet. So.
Well, so, but isn't there a finer point to bring yet a finer point to the table, is that if you're owning the recursive server that's actually looking that up, you can ignore. If you own DNS 6.4 or NAT 6.4 and you are the recursive server looking that up, you can choose to ignore that and just lie to the client. I hate to say that word. We are lying to the client at that point. That said, yes, this is a real record out of the zone. Just trust us because we're your corporate domain server, DNS server. We will happily lie to you to tell you the right information.
That's right. And in the words of Winston Churchill, like, the truth must be accompanied by a bodyguard of lies at times.
Yeah. I mean, it is usually the case that since it's a simple stub resolver querying that recursive DNS server, it just has to trust server is going to do DNSSEC validation on its behalf and won't lie to it. And in this case, if it lies to it, well, it'll be none the wiser. If you did, for whatever reason, have another recursive DNS server querying the name server that was doing DNS 6.4, well, then you might actually break something.
So besides those two aspects of sort of the transition for V6, I mean, is there anything in sort of, you know, you've had a pretty good breadth of career experience at Infoblox, and Infoblox obviously did a lot of evangelism around IPv6 in terms of the adoption side story. And you guys have a product that's really sort of built and suited to being able to do work with V6. Is there any sort of advice that you would want to share with the listeners around sort of like, hey, this is something you should consider around your V6 adoption, you know, planning and bigger thought process? Is there anything that you think would be important to share with them?
Well, I mean, I would certainly reassure your community of listeners that there's nothing to worry about on the DNS side of things. DNS is ready to accommodate IPv6, both in forward mapping and reverse mapping. So don't hold up your IPv6 deployment because of DNS. DNS is ready.
All the rest of the network, maybe not so much, but DNS is.
I can't speak for any other components on the network, but
all I can envision is that meme that goes around with everything's burning in the background. It's like, this is fine. So DNS has is written across the mug. This is fine.
It's the dog with the hat, right? That's
right, exactly. Yeah, when everything else is burning, and you know, so the rest of the world is burning for the V6 adoption, but DNS is fine. Well, on that note, so do you expect DNS just overall, and let's just talk bigger picture besides V6, do you think DNS overall has any other additional, like, bigger impacts for sort of helping around, you know, what's going on the internet in general? Just some interesting tidbits to share with the audience around sort of what's going on at a bigger level on DNS overall.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the most interesting things happening with DNS over the last several years have been its use by other types of applications. So, for example, you guys are probably familiar with DKIM, domain keys, identified mail. DKIM was sort of an effort to store email authentication and authorization stuff in DNS, so that, for example, if I sent you a email message, you could, your mail server could validate that it was really sent from me, which is pretty cool because I'd have public key information that was stored in DNS. There was also something called SPF, Sender Policy Framework, and SPF would store email authorization data for a company. So for example, Infoblox could say, hey, if you receive email from infoblox.com, make sure it came from one of these email servers, right? These are the only ones that are actually authorized to send email from infoblox.com. Mm-hmm.
Right. It's like a distributed whitelist, right? That's the way I sort of think of it. It's a distributed whitelist distributed from a database.
Yeah.
In the same way that DNS is.
Yeah, or sort of the reverse of an MX record, right? An MX record says, if you have email and it's destined to the following domain name, then here are the mail servers you have to send it to. The reverse is sort of the SPF information that says, if you have email and it's from this domain name, these are the mail servers it had to have come from.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's pretty widely adopted around, right? Both SPF and DKIM are gaining traction. I know SPF is definitely gaining pretty widespread adoption, but DKIM's on the rise in terms of companies that are using and making sure that that's something that they can do for secure, for sort of the secure side of validating what's going on the DNS. At least it seems like from what I'm seeing just commercially out there.
Yeah. From what I've heard, both DKIM and SPF have taken advantage of the fact that there's a huge concentration of power in the email business, and the big email hosting providers, Gmail, Hotmail, they're still around, right? Hotmail. Yes. And
Yahoo's still around too.
Yeah, all those guys use it to communicate among themselves. And so already, I mean, if you just count the amount of email that's passed back and forth between those providers, it's a pretty substantial proportion of the email that crosses the internet.
Is there any other interesting projects on the DNS side that's sort of up and coming, that's sort of new, that people are noodling on outside of, you know, sort of wider adoption there, or is it, are we reaching the slowdown pace for DNS?
There's actually a surprising amount of life in this 30 plus year old protocol. two other applications, which are sort of complementary to each other, that we're using DNS for are, there are two record types. The one, what's called the TLSA record, and the other is called the CAA record. Have you guys heard of those?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. But why don't we, for the, so yeah, so everyone else will dive into
it. No, I just want to mention them by name and then they can go look them up. Yeah. So
we give homework here.
Yeah, the right. TLSA record is kind of cool. There are various versions of the TLSA record depending on what you want to do, but the idea is that you can wean yourself almost entirely from any dependency on a certification authority. So, for example, if you say, hey, I don't want to pay whomever, I don't know, Komodo, Symantec, whatever, for a certificate. I just want to generate my own certificate for my website, and I'm just going to store it in DNS, you can do that, which is pretty cool. And it does sort of require that you actually use DNSSEC to sign the zone, right? That's important to do. But you can do that. I mean, your web server would still actually present the certificate, but then in order to validate the certificate, the validation would be done via a query, a DNS query. And then you can also do various types of binding instead. If you still want to go to a CA, which is perfectly fine, you could then use a different form of TLSA record to say, I want my TLSA record to say, this CA is my CA. Mm-hmm. Right. And the idea there is that I think that Dan Kaminsky counted recently, and apparently within most browsers, there are something like 1,500 CAs that are ultimately trusted to issue TLS certs, which is an enormous number. And, you know,
all totally reliable.
Exactly. You know, some of them are run by organizations or in countries that you might not want to extend trust to.
That's right.
And some of them, unfortunately, have over their history accidentally issued certs for domain names that they shouldn't have. You know, Google.com, Microsoft.com, any number of other web properties that they shouldn't have. This basically gives you the ability to say, "Damn it, you know, my CA is Symantec, and if you see a TLS cert that's, you know, legit, that looks legitimate, but it comes, you know, it's signed by somebody other than say Symantec, then don't believe it. The CAA record is actually sort of the converse of that. The CAA record is a way of communicating to CAs who your CA is, so that any CA that follows these sort of basic common basic best practices would actually check the CAA record to see that you were their customer before issuing a cert. Mm-hmm. So you could say in your CAA record, Symantec is our CA, and if somebody else who is well behaved was requested to issue a cert for that domain name, they would say, "Oh no, I'm sorry. It looks like only Symantec can do that."
No, that's cool. Slick. Well, we always espouse on the V6 side, but I mean, it's super important. As Scott likes to say, what does he say about all the core fundamental protocols for the internet? It's like broccoli. It's good for you.
that's right. And so, well, and since you've invoked Scott, I think we should maybe mention the recent blog post that he put up on the Infoblox IPv6 Center of Excellence blog, which was related to whether or not you should dual stack your DNS name servers. And of course, he's advocating for dual stacking one's DNS name servers. And I wondered if Cricket might want to weigh in on why that might be important. Of course, you can certainly read and should read Scott's blog post on this if you're listening on the Infoblox community website. But I'd love to hear your opinion, Cricket, on why that's an important step.
Oh, I don't think it's important at all.
Well, there we go. There you have it.
No, it is a very good idea, for sure. I think both on internet-facing recursive DNS servers and internet-facing authoritative DNS servers, it's a good idea to run them dual stack. On the recursives, because it gives you the ability to resolve domain names that are hosted on name servers that are IPv6 only, gives you more possible endpoints to talk to if you're trying to do resolution of a domain name, and you get a set of name servers that have a mix of IPv4 and IPv6 addresses, gives you more addresses to query. And
so you could conceivably see some performance benefits from that.
You could absolutely. If for example, the latency over IPv6 to get to one of those name servers is better than the latency over IPv4 to get to the rest of those name servers, then most bind name servers and other name servers will begin to prefer using IPv6 to resolve domain names in that particular zone. Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing. And conversely, if you're maintaining an IPv6 presence on the internet, if you have a website out there that people can reach over IPv4 and IPv6 or other internet-facing resources, then servers that respond over both IPv4 and IPv6. Because you never know when you're going to be talking to the people who are trying to access your website actually have like IPv6 only connectivity. That's increasingly common in, for example, the Asia Pacific region, where there aren't any more IPv4 addresses to be had. So, if you offer IPv4 DNS only, then those people are probably going to have to go through some, translation technology in order to resolve things, if they can do it at all. Whereas over IPv6, they can come in natively and resolve domain names.
So Cricket, how can the audience follow you on maybe on the internet? If you could plug maybe, I don't know if you're blogging actively, but we've talked about your books. I think everyone knows on that one, but maybe public appearances, your Twitter handle, anything else that you want to share?
Yeah, well, they can always follow me at Cricket on DNS. And I do still have some blog postings out there on the Infoblox website.
Tom, you want to share quickly how folks can find you?
Sure. At IPv6Tom is my Twitter handle. I blog on the Infoblox Center of Excellence IPv6 blog as well. And of course, I have my O'Reilly book, IPv6 Address Planning, available on Amazon if you're interested in the wonderful world of planning your IPv6 deployment and how to slice and dice your IPv6 allocation, that sort of thing.
I'm Ed Horley. It's at E. Horley on Twitter. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. Until next time, we'll see you on the internet, the IPv6 internet.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.